Ever launched a cross-functional project and by week two, progress just stalls and everyone's frustrated? Kind of a leading question we all have, right? So in today's episode of How to Build a Growth System, Chris and I are going to dig into why silos form and how to dismantle them. So spoiler, it's not about making people collaborate harder. It's actually about fixing the systems that make collaboration hard in the first place.
Absolutely. So let's maybe just set the scene in a sort of growth team context. So let's say we're, you know, SaaS Corp. We're launching a new GTM motion. Marketing's pushing out campaigns. They're capturing leads. You know, great stuff is happening. MQL graft is going up. But sales, well, they're saying that they're junk. They're not touching them. They're doing their thing. You know, product, you know, they're shipping all these new features, but no one's actually really asked for them. And success are there just picking up the pieces and trying to hit their metrics. Well, unfortunately, that fictional scenario is one that plays out to a greater or lesser extent in a whole ton of companies, you know, every single day. Everyone's doing their job, but the system's failing.
Yeah, Chris, I've seen this pattern over and over at basically every point on the scale, from like a startup so small that we could all fit into a car to like a 100,000 person corporate. And universally got smart, capable people. Everyone wants to do their job well. Everyone would ideally like to collaborate effectively, but basically we return to the same old friction. So it's like the structure of the organization really overpowers the intent of the people in the organization.
And that's exactly it. You know, I think it's such a great way of kind of putting it. You know, the structure of the org overpowers the intent of the people. And I think that I've been reading a bit of a W. Edwards Deming this week. So, you know, he's got some great systems quote. And I think one that immediately comes to mind there is a bad system will beat a good person every single time. And it's so true. But I think that most leaders probably assume that misalignment, you know, silos, versions of that sort of, you know, picture I painted a second ago is a cultural issue. You know, the teams just don't talk. But as we know, and as I'm sure the sort of listeners to this show will know, you know, that's really the real problem at work. They're simply responding to the structure in which they're operating. So whether that's the sort of purpose that they're sort of working towards, you know, the incentives, the tools, ultimately it's the structures that have been designed knowingly or unknowingly, and that's quite a key point, within the system that's creating this behavior.
So something that's been interesting to me in researching for this episode was thinking about how that org chart, or I guess the sort of organization, org design, which I guess goes, as we discuss often, goes a bit beyond what's actually on the chart, really actually shapes the customer experience as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's quite an interesting one. I mean, it was a new one to me, actually, in the research, but I think that was called Conway's Law or something, that, you know, the way we organize the team shapes the systems and the products that we build. And therefore, if you've got division within your org chart, you know, the org chart has walls up, the product and the customer experience is probably going to have some walls in it too. So I thought that was quite an interesting kind of way of thinking about the problem, is actually the sort of visible structure, you know, the org chart, the way that everyone is ordered in the organization is one of the sort of, you know, portents of how the experience of acting within that system is going to work.
Yeah, no, that was a fascinating part. Well, I hadn't really considered even framing the problem in that way, and it really kind of opens up whole new avenues of thinking about how to solve this. But I think in reality, certainly in my experience, leaders tend not to think too far out of the box on this problem and keep trying to fix this with off-site get-togethers and some sort of kind of half-hearted incentive program, or of course more alignment meetings, instead of actually sort of tearing
the alignment meetings.
Yes, tearing the plaster off and actually kind of looking at the system design, or even asking them themselves the question, is it the system, essentially? Like, what? Why do you think that is? You've, I guess, been a leader and a follower in this respect. So you probably have quite an interesting perspective on it.
Yeah, I think the Conway's Law thing is interesting, but I wonder whether in many ways it's temptingly oversimplistic. You know, it's relating back the problem to the things that we can see. And, you know, in the sort of iceberg theory, you know, that it will be a part of the problem. But ultimately, I think that, as you said at the start, org design is a lot more than, you know, the structure of the people within the org chart. And I think ultimately it is because it's easier to say, we just need to collaborate better, collaborate harder, than it is to actually challenge the systemic issues that are underlying that lack of collaboration. So whether that is reporting lines, or whether it is misaligned metrics, or whether it is, you know, comp plans that don't incentivize the right behaviors, you know, it's easier for leaders to treat the symptoms, you know, more meetings, more check-ins, more alignment meetings, that it is to actually fix the underlying rot that's causing the problem. And systems that reward local successes over system outcomes are always going to be problematic. In fact, actually, I might just launch straight in with my second Deming quote of the episode, which is,
you couldn't wait, could you?
Well, I couldn't, but also it's absolutely the right quote at the right time, because it's one that I really love, and it's, you know, it's an oldie but a goodie, as they say, which is, every single system is perfectly optimized to produce the results that you're getting right now. And I think that it is such a pithy and but such a true statement, that for these leaders, you know, it is the system that exists within it. It is the structure. It is the elements within that system and the way that they are interconnected. It's not just the one thing. How are we talking to each other?
So I'm thinking here about the relationship of sort of how difficult this is to do with the organizational complexity. Now, as I said earlier, we are, you know, I've seen these problems in a startup that can all fit in one car, right up to really complex corporates. But I must say, when I've been in a small startup or something like that, or indeed kind of doing some work for some of them, there's always that plan to scale up. The plan is always about scale. And I wonder if sometimes there is an underestimation, or perhaps a misunderstanding, of how that complexity will grow as the organization grows, and what the actual impact of that is on sort of organizational friction and coordination and stuff like that. It'd be great to kind of hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're really talking about here is the cost of coordination, which is really around how, as organizations grow, the cost of collaboration, so, you know, aligning people, making decisions, delivering actions, rises exponentially, you know, rather than in a linear fashion. So, you know, if you're going from a startup where everyone can fit in a car to, you know, even where you just need a second car, you're maybe going from, you know, 4 to 8 or 3 to 6 or whatever. Doubling the amount of people doesn't just double the cost of communication, the cost of collaboration. It triples, because if you think about it, you know, every time you add another sort of node in the system, you know, another person, in this sort of simplistic example that we're working through here, it adds an exponential amount of alignment requirements, because ultimately the lines that you can draw on the chart between those people increase by far more than just the incremental percentage of headcount that you've increased by. So, you know, it's something that, as you go from the one car example to the, you know, multinational example, you can see the lines on that chart are just incomprehensible. And therefore, we have to respond to that complexity by putting in, well, what you might term bureaucracy. We have to put in the structures in place to enable that to happen, and they can be successful to a greater or lesser extent.
So I'm thinking that it's important to note that sometimes this could be a people problem. We're not dismissing that out of hand. I think you could probably all think of sort of cringing examples of where it perhaps was a people problem. But I think our contention is that in general, this is a systemic problem. So what's the signal we can look to sort of diagnose that the friction is systemic and not just, you know, like a problem with, say, for example, the simplest example would be two particular people who just can't seem to collaborate.
Yeah, I think when you're looking at two people that can't collaborate, you probably are looking at a people problem. But when you've got two teams that are each pointing the finger at each other, I think that very often the case is that they are pointing their fingers not at each other, but at the sort of unseen thing in the middle that everyone can feel and experience, but you can't actually see. And that is, you know, for fans of, you know, system diagramming, is really the interconnections. It is the sort of unseen linkages in between. And this can be stuff like, you know, unclear ownership of things, people thinking, you know, I thought the other person had that, or siloed information, you know, absolutely a classic, you know, I just didn't know that something had happened, or, you know, we didn't know that that lead had come in, or we didn't know that you were going to an event next week, or whatever it might be. I think very often, though, it's about misaligned goals, it's around horizontal goal alignment. It's ultimately different teams caring about, being measured on, being rewarded on things that don't quite align. And it's something that we've talked about a lot, and I probably won't, you know, we won't disappear down that particular rabbit hole in this episode, but horizontally misaligned goals are definitely a lens to sort of view the problem through. But it can be workflow gaps. It can be the fact that, you know, teams are using different systems, they don't talk to each other, duplication of information, you know, poor integration of systems at a sort of technical functional level. Ultimately, it's just going to be a whole mix of things that just mean that stuff drops in the middle.
Whose role do you think that should be to do this sort of friction mapping exercise? Who should own that within the organization?
That is a great question.
I'm not expecting a job title here, but I just thought I would throw that one at you, because it's kind of relevant in a sort of meta way to what we're talking about here. Like, is someone who's going to take ownership? But that's not in anyone's job description, probably.
Do you know, I think that is probably the question of this episode, is, you know, whose problem is that? Everyone is experiencing the problem, but who's supposed to be fixing the problem? If it was someone's job and they had a job title, you know, friction analysis director, then, you know, you could point the finger at them and say, well, you haven't done your job properly. But organizations don't have that job. I'm not sure that job exists within most organizations. Whose job is that? Is it RevSpace's job? I think this is the problem that we get asked to fix very often. Maybe you should call us. It's a sort of, you know, shameless plug moment. I don't know. I think in reality, the issue is in itself cross-functional. If you've got a revenue operations team, then the revenue operations team should be taking charge of the tech strategy. They should be taking charge of the automation, the orchestration of information flowing between the teams. If it is a goals problem, then ultimately that is a problem that needs to flow uphill. The role of the exec team should be to drive cross-functional alignment, because it should be that they are considering the full goal stack in a horizontal fashion, not just how things are being reported upwards to the top goal and thinking that sounds about right. I'm not suggesting that that's all exec teams do by any matter, but I do think that it's a problem that we see very, very often. So I think it is a broken process in a lot of organizations, is to really conceptualize, okay, well, if marketing are doing step A and B and sales are doing step C and D, does B to C actually connect in a way that is seamless, tightly coupled? And that is something which I think more attention should be on as everyone does their sort of goal setting exercises. I think that it's also contingent on the teams themselves to to flag when misalignment exists, because misalignment is very often quiet. You know, it is a signal which exists and can be felt and heard by everybody, but it isn't necessarily stopping anyone doing their job as they define it within the tight boundaries of what is on their job description. So it often takes somebody that really cares within a team to put their head above the parapet and say, this isn't working. And I think that if anyone's listening to this episode and they're thinking, yeah, I'm feeling that, then, you know, be that person. Sometimes it can be uncomfortable. Sometimes it can be unpopular. I think that's why people don't do it. But ultimately, if you can be the catalyst for change, I think it probably also could be the catalyst for career advancement, because it shows that ultimately you can put your hands around and conceptualize a problem like that and have the, you know, the chops to get it fixed. So, you know, apologies if that is bad advice, but I think that it is necessary. That's an action.
Yeah, hopefully you haven't just got anyone fired, Chris. No, but I think, in all seriousness, this ends up coming back to getting the deep structure right in terms of, for example, purpose and how we measure success. And if everyone's pulling towards the same North Star in the right way, then suddenly this becomes everyone's problem to solve, right?
Yeah.
I'm also thinking about, well, what not everyone maybe has a background in systems thinking and sort of systems dynamics and drawing systems diagrams and things like that. Be good to dive into, I guess, some of the tools that people might use to be able to kind of diagnose these problems, like value stream mapping, for example.
Yeah, I mean, value stream mapping is one of those great exercises that sounds really complicated, but actually isn't in the least. You know, it's something that can be done with a bunch of post-its and some pens and some basic information, or even some assumptions, you know, that can be tested later. So yeah, I think that's a great one to dive into. I mean, so value stream mapping. I mean, ultimately, value stream mapping is an exercise in putting on paper how a process happens and what exercises or what elements of that process create value and which do not, and ascribing some sort of time to that. So value stream mapping really has its roots in Lean, and therefore was originally, I believe, put together for looking at production processes and trying to make, you know, manufacturing production lines more efficient. And, you know, how long are we waiting for, you know, the widget to arrive at the station and all of that. But you can absolutely use it really effectively within service-based organizations and particularly within growth teams, because we have a lot of, you know, multi-step processes that take time and often have humans in loop and different systems and different handoffs. So it can be a great tool. So actually, let me give you a real example that we've been looking at recently on behalf of a customer. And this was actually around lead management and actually what happens to as a lead comes into the organization and how quick it gets to respond to. So if you are mapping that process out, essentially what we want to do is put time and actions together within a chart. So whether you're sticking post-its on a wall or you're drawing it in a mirror or whatever, you know, you say, okay, well, the first action is someone submits a form, say you've got an inbound lead. Then, well, where has that gone is the first thing, and who is it gone to? So let's say that you're, you know, living in 2005 and it's come into your WordPress site and it's gone into your, you know, whatever it was called, contact form 7, and it's, you know, been sent to someone's inbox. Well, how long is it going to sit in the inbox? You know, has it been there for 2 hours, 8 hours, 3 days? Did anyone see it at all? So, you know, you'd put node one is, you know, form submitted. Node two instantly is gone to inbox, then sits in inbox for awaiting review for what? 2 hours, 4 hours? So we've had the moment, and then we're 4 hours into the process and no value has been created. But then it's seen by someone and it's assigned to an SDR, and that might take 5 minutes to being assigned to the SDR. So we've got 5 minutes of value that's happened in the first 4 hours. Then it's been assigned to the SDR. they got a notification email, maybe. How long did they, you know, take them to actually see that? Maybe they have a 30-minute delay. Then they go look at it. So we're at this point, whatever we are, 4 hours and 45 minutes into the process, and we've had 15 minutes of value probably at this point that's being created. Then they go research the company. They hopefully craft a beautifully personalized email that's thinking about their industry context and how it applies to our product. And maybe they spent 30 minutes doing that, and they send it, you know, an hour perhaps after it's been assigned to them. So we're 5 hours end to end, perhaps. And we've done 45 minutes of value creating activity in that 5 hours. So essentially within a value stream map, what we've got then is 4 hours and 15 minutes of potential to create more value, to save time, to create the sort of value coefficient to be higher. And therefore, we're really looking at those delays and those handoffs and those system integrations and saying, okay, well, that is our sort of fertile ground for defrictioning the process, for removing, non-value creating activity for it, and therefore getting back to the customer quicker. And when you're doing things at that level of a very sort of particular process, you know, value stream mapping is a great one because you've got functional handoffs. You know, don't perhaps use value stream mapping to map, you know, how your team coordinates for a week or whatever that might be. It might not be impossible, but certainly it's not going to be quite as action orientated in its output.
Yeah, and it's not just that it's sort of action orientated and I guess actionable. I guess as we covered very, very early in our sort of podcasting journey, this isn't just the example you gave there. It's not just about freeing up SDR's time to do more selling, although it can potentially do that. It's not just about, maybe you need fewer SDRs or something like that. It's also because, you know, within a very short period of time, if the lead hasn't had any sort of response or outreach, the kind of effect, the usefulness of that lead kind of drops off exponentially. So this is a really impactful value stream to look at as well. And maybe there's a lesson in that for where you do this sort of mapping.
100%. And, you know, that... it's one of those problems that no one's really looking at. You know, leads come in, they get responded to, the response happened the same day, you know, the date stamp's the same on the input and the output. Is there really a problem? Well, as you say, there absolutely is a problem because customer experience is suffering, SDR bandwidth is being taken up by doing things. You've got a human in the loop there that's assigning stuff that doesn't need to be there, that could be doing something else. So you've got all this opportunity cost of people's time where they could be doing other value creating activities, but you've also got a poor customer experience. I mean, I remember doing a bit of research a long time ago now when I worked in the car industry about leads coming through a website for new car inquiries. And it actually suggested that the optimum time to get back to an online inquiry was 5 minutes, and that lead efficacy after 1 hour had dropped by 50%, I think it was. And after 4 hours, it was the same as if you cold called them, which was just nuts. But you can really see that sometimes. You know, you go back, and if you're a poor SDR that's having to follow up an ebook download from 2 weeks ago, I mean, the amount of people that will even remember they did that action will be, you know, limited.
No one ever remembers. The only time they've ever remembered, literally, is when somebody said, "Oh, blimey, you're quick. I've got it open just now. I literally just opened it." It's the only time I've had someone ever in my sort of SDR days ever had someone acknowledge that they had downloaded some piece of content or anything. Everything else is just a mystery to them. So I've really seen that in action.
Absolutely.
And I know the episode's not about this, but it's a really sort of germane example.
And so the question is, well, what do you do about it? And I think that when we were solving this, you know, looking at this particular sort of basic value stream map, really what we were doing is building a business case, in this case for agentic automation. So what we did with that information, we said, okay, well, actually you times that by the number of, you know, leads that you're getting in a month, in a year. You look at the amount of time that's going to that, you look at the lag time. And actually, if we just built in an auto assignment of that lead. We put a contact rotation automation in place that said, okay, well, it's just going to go to the person that's had the lead least likely in least recently in your SDR team, and that we're then going to go and automatically enrich that lead so that rather than having four fields from the form, they've got, you know, 24 fields of dense information, and then we're going to feed that dense information along with a load of other information about your product and positioning into a prompt to an LLM. And then we're going to return a nicely crafted email instantly back to the rep in Slack and in CRM for them to review. Then suddenly, you know, that 5 hours lag time to get to the personalized email is turned into literally, you know, sub 5 minutes. And they've got a notification where they're actually looking, which is in Slack or Teams. And they can just click on the button, go in, review the email, you know, click send, off they go. And then suddenly you've got 13 plus minutes more of actual action time in the human beings in that process. You've got nigh on 5 hours quicker response time to the customer. And you've done that with a simple set of automations that are now possible with, you know, the API accessible kind of low cost LLMs that we're now, you know, able to utilize within our organizations. And that is just transformational in one tiny process. And you sort of times that up by the number of processes that your growth team's running, you know, your marketing team, your sales team are running every single day. And okay, AI is not going to be the answer to all those problems, unfortunately. But you know, the value stream mapping and being able to kind of put things into that sort of business context of people and time and opportunity cost is a great way to really start building the case to make changes.
Maybe we should sort of zoom out a bit and sort of talk systemic fixes in general. Don't want to get too bogged down on this one specific aspect. That's kind of a good link to talking about fixing the problem, I guess, rather than just the diagnosis piece.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I say, if we zoom back out and we think about what solves the problem of being in silos. Okay, well, what is the problem created by being in silos? Well, I mean, as we've just discussed, we typically see that as being misaligned actions, you know, misaligned expectations, lack of feedback, lack of information in terms of the fact that something has happened. So really, you start building on top of that. Well, there's a few kind of groups of solutions that you're going to start to apply. And in systems world, we're going to try and apply all of those in a way that kind of creates a new system, an updated system, if you like. And I think that one of the key things for me is really about kind of aligning on goals in the first place. Yeah, if everybody is pointing in the right direction, as you said, if everyone is working towards the same North Star, if everybody is really seeing how their kind of local actions apply to global success, and that we can tie together our desired outcomes across functions to create the result that we're looking for, then, you know, we're not working across purposes. We're not working in such a way as we have misalignment baked in, because people do what they're measured on. You know, we haven't said that for a while on the podcast, but it's a favorite. If we make sure everyone's measured on the right stuff and those goals are all aligned and those goals are shared, then a lot of this becomes a lot easier. And ultimately, it becomes a lot easier for the reasons we were talking about in the last episode. You know, we start creating the powers of self-organization because people know where they're going and they start doing things by themselves without you needing to tell them. So I guess the sort of natural bedfellow of shared goals is probably shared context. So if we're putting everything in a place in the center where everybody can see it, you know, we've got these kind of live dashboards that are tracking all the right things, that everyone can see their metrics together. You know, we've clarified the ownership of those metrics and the actions that drive them, then we don't actually need to explain as much anymore. You know, we can move a lot faster because we can see not only do we have shared goals, but we can see our achievement towards those goals as a collective. And you know, self-organization starts to kick in. We can start seeing exactly where we're off track, bluntly, who is off track, which teams are off track, and we can collectively organize ourselves to get back on track. And that is really a big part, I think, of fixing those kind of silo issues. But it's also a lot about feedback loops. You know, we talk about feedback loops a lot on here, but in this case, it's just creating those rituals, those kind of the operating rhythm where we can triage issues together. And that doesn't necessarily mean we just need more meetings, because as we said at the top, you know, alignment meetings, quote unquote, don't tend to be that successful at getting anyone aligned. But actually, which is why I sort of deliberately use the word rituals. A ritual implies that something has happened rather than something has been talked about. So if we've got that kind of shared context, we've got that sort of async information that everybody has got access to, and we kind of create these moments where we can triage problems together, and we do that based on the shared context and the data, and we can come together and say, okay, well, this is off track. You know, why do we think that might be? You know, we can kind of do the, you know, the red teaming exercise. We can do the sort of, you know, we can do the thought exercise of, okay, well, what could we try? What is the hypothesis here? How can we test that? How can we put that into action? If it's a bigger problem, do we need to form a sort of, you know, cross-functional team here that's going to be mission-based, that's going to go and try and, you know, fix a systemic issue?
Effectively outcome-based, right? So they should, in theory, be pulling towards the same North Star there, because it's a kind of outcome-based cross-functional team, right?
Exactly. You know, they've got clear purpose. And I think probably the final thing, I'll probably think of some more things later, but the final thing that certainly comes to mind is about alignment of incentives. You know, if we've got shared goals, are people being incentivized in the right way to achieve those goals? And so often it's not the case. If we have a sales target to hit, you know, it's an easy one to kind of conceptualize. What are we actually rewarding?
What are you celebrating?
Yeah, exactly. You know, and if we're an SDR team and we're being rewarded on meetings booked, then guess what? You're probably going to book a lot of meetings. The question is, will anyone turn up to them? Will the people that turn up to them actually be someone that you want to spend your AE's time, or whoever it is that's going to be on the meeting's time, talking to?
Or who knows why they're in the meeting?
Yeah, exactly. So are we actually incentivizing the right behaviors that are going to lead to the right outcomes, that are going to help us achieve our goals? Because again, not wanting to go down the sort of, you know, purpose episode rabbit hole here, but purpose is fractal. We talk about that a lot. So have you fractured it in the right way? Have we pulled it into the right component parts into the right jigsaw puzzle pieces that fit back together again when they've been achieved?
I know you don't want to dive too much, for good reason, dive too much into that kind of deep structure and purpose, but I guess it is also really relevant here. You know, we're thinking about that friction between, I don't know, the CMO and the CRO, and they fundamentally disagree on lead quality, for example, is one mm-hmm. of the examples we keep going to. And they both essentially they have this fundamental tension, like competing philosophies, but it's essentially the system that created those competing philosophies. So shared metrics, shared purpose, shared kind of outcome-focused cross-functional teams, for example, is essentially forcing philosophical alignment there. Maybe philosophical is too grandiose a name for it, but essentially the mindset will become aligned if those things are in place and aligned.
Yeah, absolutely. And every systems problem in business pretty much can be viewed through those two lenses, and needs to be viewed through those two lenses of sort of purpose and structure. And okay, arguably goals and metrics are part of the structure, but I think for the purpose of explanation, you know, the North Star, where are we pointing the system, needs to be looked at, and how does that break down into each individual department, into each individual sub-team, each individual contributor, and how then are all of those pieces stitched together in terms of that sort of more visible system structure of operating rhythm and software and integration and automation and orchestration of data and reporting systems and shared dashboards and production processes, whatever it might be, those are the things that you can do the value stream mapping on, but you really have to make sure that the value that you are trying to create is clear in every single team. And that's really around that kind of purpose and alignment to North Star. So you need to come at the problem from both angles. And if you do, the silos will disappear because you are engineering them out of your system.
Chris, what I love about this approach, your approach to these problems in general, is that it's diagnostic before it's prescriptive. So I think my experience, and probably most of the listeners' experience of consultants, is it will come in with a playbook. This playbook is proven to get X results, and they use that finish line language that consultants are taught to use. Whereas you're saying, actually start with the system and let the system tell you like what's broken.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is very often the case that whilst they will fit into those broad buckets of different problems, collaboration, operating rhythm, the way that people interact, processes perhaps as a related part of that. Technology integration would be another bucket that you often see a lot of problems in. People just can't see the data. They don't know stuff's happening. It's dropping between the cracks. Those problems will be different. And even if you speak to three organizations that all have technical integration problems, they will all be different. They will all exist in a different context. So you have to be diagnostic first, because we have to really understand what's happening. And that is why, you know, when we do our growth system design programs, when we kind of go through that consultative process that we have developed, the process is not a playbook. It is a diagnostic methodology for working out what the problems are. You know, we build the playbook afterwards to fix the problems as they are presented to us by the organization that we are working with. And if we look at those core kind of diagnostic exercises, we will have one that is around purpose. So how do the goals, you know, stack up through the growth team? How horizontally aligned are those goals? You know, are we build an issues list, you know, looking at purpose and the goal stack and metrics and the North Star alignment. And we'll look at the people. So we'll do a sort of team design exercise. So, you know, what is the purpose of each individual? What are they accountable for? What can they make decisions on? What are they actually measured on? Does that all align? You know, build an issues list from that. We'll look at that sort of value stream mapping type exercise where, you know, we'll look at the flow of a lead, or we'll look at the flow of data through the organization. What systems does it touch? What processes does it run through? You know, what people touch them? Where are the handoffs? And we'll build an issues list and you know, and a few more things, as you know, besides. But ultimately, you're looking at that sort of multimodal problem. You're looking at that in through those different lenses, but you're building one issues list that you can then start building a project plan from. And that for me, I think, is the, you know, the way to start thinking about that. But of course, that's a reasonably large exercise. And I think you can probably start smaller than that.
Yeah, on that starting small piece, I guess that would be a great way to close out, is to just give some practical advice on what people can actually do this week, because it all must sound a bit daunting when you buy into the idea as a growth leader. You buy into the idea that, oh yeah, okay, it's the system that's a problem, so now what, I have to map out my whole system and do all this stuff on top of everything. Like, what's something that people can actually do like this week?
Look for where the pain is most acute, I think. Is there one process, you know, one project, one handoff, one area that we really need to shine a light on, that everyone just sort of knows is there? And whilst you need to draw the boundary in the right place around a problem, i.e. we need to make sure that we've got the right amount of associations included within our diagnostic, if you look at a project, our project stalled out, for instance, then we really need to, okay, well, let's just shine a light on that. Let's look at where the problem is most acute, where the pain is being felt, and therefore we've really got a sort of business case in inverted commas for spending some time and looking at that. Because so often that's part of the problem, is that the pain isn't seen, it isn't felt. We don't know what will happen when we fix it strongly enough to know that we're going to stop doing something else, which seems really important. But if we look at one thing where we're feeling some pain, you know, that's a great catalyst for action. And then what we need to do is map that out. You know, what is the process happening there? You know, what is the handoffs? What are the delays? What are the metrics that are being used? And my advice would be to create a sort of cross-functional team, a sort of mission-based team to go and fix that thing. And cross-functional is really the key, because so often these problems are going to be where different teams interact, where different people, sub-teams, whatever they might be. Problems don't tend to exist inside one team. They tend to exist in the gaps between teams, or at least certainly the major problems. So draw a boundary around one problem, whether it's a lead handoff, whether it's the, like the example I gave earlier, of we're just not getting back to customers in the right, you know, speed or in the right volume or whatever it might be. Go map out that process, go work out where the problems are, go work out where the non-value creating activities are taking place. Think about how we can put that into a sort of mission-based project of its own to go fix that. Really clearly define the purpose of what we want to achieve. Create that sort of North Star within the problem of, we need to cut, you know, lead response time down to 15 minutes, or we need to reduce the amount of time we're spending on this particular process by 50%. And then everyone knows what good looks like. So we can go and start to work out how we're going to achieve that. And then build a sort of rhythm of collaboration for that project that focuses on diagnosis and action, you know, that create the rituals of diagnostic kind of activity within that team. So what are we measuring? What are the actions? Who is going to do those actions? How are we going to track the efficacy of that over time? And I really think that having a sort of guiding light of a single KPI or a clear purpose or a clear number that people are working towards is going to make that team so much more effective, because there is no ambiguity of what success looks like. You know, making something better is not a good aim. We shouldn't fall at the last hurdle and start talking about metrics and goals and how to set them. But ultimately, you know, do something tight, do something meaningful that people are feeling. So when you fix it, and you will fix it if you go through and put that sort of focus on it and you put that kind of clarity in place as how we're going to fix it, then people will see that, wow, you know, actually just fixing that one little thing has made this big difference. And what else could we do? And that's a great catalyst then for doing something which is larger scale, or just keep picking at the problems like that. You know, you'll get there in the end if you do it that way. Sometimes that's the best way.
I think one of the crucial points to note there was that idea about the shared network, like getting these sort of stakeholders. I never see this happen in practice, except during my time working with you, Chris, where we actually sit down together with people that maybe, you know, the example of the CMO and the CRO, and actually ask what shared metric would make us all win together. And I think essentially if you can't define a shared metric, no playbook or alignment meeting or change to the process is really going to save you.
Yeah, absolutely. So ultimately, you know, it's about taking a diagnostic view of the problems that are in front of us. It's stop asking, you know, why aren't our teams collaborating, and starting asking, well, what is it about the system context that they're existing in that's making it hard for them to collaborate effectively? And you know, then take on that process that we've just described, think about it through the lens of purpose, think about it through the lens of system structure, and ultimately get fixing.
Yeah, Chris, I'm going to rein us in here before we get into a new topic, as we often do right at the end. Worth noting for the listeners that if they're interested to look into a bit more about breaking silos, how to build cross-functional teams, you have in fact penned a Medium article on exactly that.
Indeed I have, yes.
we should link to that in the show notes. And I guess also worth pointing out that RevSpace will, of course, quite happily do work with you on a friction audit if some of this methodology sounds perhaps interesting, but maybe you don't know where to start. That would be a good time to sort of pick up the phone and speak to RevSpace about that.
Absolutely. Two shameless plugs in one episode. That's a, that might be a record, actually.
I think that's actually three shameless plugs.
Is it? Wow.
One earlier. and that's before I fumble my outro, which I think will continue.
Oh, you said you practice, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I lied. I didn't practice. and now the time has come. We do actually have to wrap up there. We're a little bit over time, as usual. How to Build a Growth System is brought to you, as you just heard, by RevSpace. It's a growth systems consultancy that connects B2B organizations with the future of growth. So RevSpace offers account-based growth managed services, go-to-market engineering projects, for example. So you should check them out on rev.space. Please don't forget to follow and rate the podcast. It really helps us to bring the content to a wider audience. And as always, we'd really appreciate a moment of your time to tell us what you think. That's all we've got time for this week. Thanks very much. See you next week.
Thanks for listening.